From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the presidential campaign from the perspective of New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan. She won a Pulitzer Prize this year for her syndicated column, Public and Private. Her columns bring the personal and the political together. Also, Your Basic Black Poet. That's the tongue-in-cheek title of a poem by Al Young about what people expect from a black poet if the black poet is, quote, for real. He'll read from his new book of collected poems. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Ripley Underwater, Patricia Highsmith's new crime novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Governor Bill Clinton spread his coattails wide over the West Coast today. This afternoon, he appeared at a rally in Orange County, California, with senatorial candidate Barbara Boxer. In Oregon, he stumped for Democrat Les O'Coyne. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Although he cautions that the race isn't over yet, Bill Clinton felt confident enough to tell a crowd of about 8,000 at the University of Oregon that as president, he would have to have help to implement his programs, asking Oregon voters to replace their incumbent Republican Senator Bob Packwood with Congressman Les O'Coyne. Clinton also asked voters to reject an anti-homosexuality initiative.
Many people look to the West and see tomorrow. They see the shape of tomorrow. I ask you to send a message to America by resoundingly defeating Resolution 9. Vote no.
The attack on Resolution 9 was also a sign of Clinton's confidence. Last time he campaigned in Oregon, he was asked how he stood on the initiative, and he avoided making a strong statement against it. Resolution 9 would ban anything that could be interpreted as state support for homosexual lifestyles. In Eugene, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush campaigned today in New Jersey, continuing his attacks on the character and judgment of Bill Clinton. The president said that a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress would inevitably lead to higher taxes. He also disparaged the pollsters who show Clinton with a big lead in New Jersey, a state the Bush Quail ticket won in 1988. The president also directed some of his criticism to independent candidate Ross Perot, who's enjoying a modest surge in the polls following the debates and a $30 million ad campaign. Mr. Bush said that Perot supporters will be wasting their votes if they cast them for the Texas billionaire. The United States began evacuating non-essential embassy personnel from Liberia today after fighting between West African peacekeepers and rebel forces outside the capital. Cindy Shiner of African News Service reports from Monrovia.
A chartered jet flew about 50 Americans out of the Liberian capital, Monrovia, today to the Ivory Coast. About 30 U.S. embassy personnel were among them. Another 100 Americans are scheduled to leave Friday. The evacuation comes as Alpha jets belonging to a West African peacekeeping force continue to bombard the suburbs to drive back rebel forces who began an assault on the capital last week. One rebel leader, known as Prince Johnson, surrendered to peacekeepers Wednesday. Meanwhile, thousands of frightened Liberians fled to the city center to escape the fighting and seek care for bullet and shrapnel wounds. International relief agencies are distributing water. The city's water and international telephone lines have been cut for at least 2 days. A curfew is in effect between 6 p.m. and 8 a.m. throughout the city. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Monrovia.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 14 points today. This is NPR News. Jury selection was completed today in the retrial of former CIA official Claire George. George is accused of lying to congressional committees in 1986 about his knowledge of the scheme to sell arms to Iran and send illegal military aid to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. George's first trial ended in a hung jury in August, and the jury foreman later said that the panel was never close to convicting the former CIA official. Japan's plans to ship plutonium from France by sea have drawn angry protests from several South American nations along the shipping route. The first of 45 shiploads of the toxic material is expected to leave France soon. NPR's David Wellner reports from Rio.
Brazil's foreign minister has notified Japan's ambassador here that it would be inconvenient for Japan to use Brazil's territorial waters for shipping the plutonium. The foreign minister meets this weekend with his counterparts from Chile and Argentina to discuss further actions against the shipment. The Chilean and Argentine foreign ministers issued a joint communique yesterday stating their governments would not permit the plutonium to be shipped through their waters. This could force Japan to transport the highly radioactive material through more turbulent international waters. The 1 1/3 tons of plutonium to be shipped from France are to be followed by 44 more shipments over the next 7 years to fuel a new series of Japanese nuclear reactors. I'm David Wellna in Rio de Janeiro.
Muslim extremists have claimed responsibility for the murder of a British woman yesterday during an attack on a tour bus in Egypt. The bus, carrying a group of Western tourists, was ambushed by gunmen from a radical offshoot of the Islamic Holy War. The attack killed a 28-year-old nurse from Gloucester, England, and injured two British men. The terrorist group issued a statement saying that it planned to attack tourists and high government officials in its effort to implement Islamic law in Egypt. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today and tomorrow, we'll be looking at the presidential campaign from the perspectives of two columnists who are colleagues but have very different points of view. The conservative columnist William Safire will be our guest tomorrow. With me now is Anna Quinlan. She won a Pulitzer Prize this year for her New York Times syndicated column, Public and Private. She formerly wrote a column called Life in the 30s that was about her life as a 30-something wife, mother, daughter, and journalist. Quinlan is also the author of the novel Object Lessons. I asked her what she sees as her turf in covering this presidential campaign.
I see myself a little bit as the anti-columnist. I've never worked in government. I've never covered the White House. I'm not traveling with this campaign. In fact, I've made a conscious effort to stay away from both of the major candidates. I guess I should add all three of the major candidates in the flesh, because for most of the campaign, I wanted to see this race the way that most voters are seeing it. And that's certainly not from the back of a sedan with a candidate at your side. I have a couple of interviews set up in the next couple of weeks with people who are higher up in the campaigns. I'm going to be talking to Hillary Clinton next week because I want very much to write a column about what her role should be if, in fact, her husband is elected president. But I've tried to stay away from the camps and spent much more time watching the debates, for example, on television, just like so many other people have done, looking at the commercials, reading the papers, and being a citizen columnist, I guess is the best way to put it.
As Anna Quinlan citizen, what are some of the issues that affect you and your family most directly in this campaign?
Well, obviously, I'm keenly interested in the economy. And quite frankly, I have no problem with Mr. Clinton's suggestion that he wants to tax people who are doing well at a higher rate, because I think that there are many, many social programs that I'm perfectly happy to fund. I'm not quite as crazy about Star Wars or some of the other permutations of the defense budget. I would hope we could do something about the public school system in this country. My children attend private schools, and quite frankly, I wish they didn't, both because of the expense and because private schools have traditionally been the great levelers. I have a 3.5-year-old daughter. I'm keenly interested in reproductive freedom, in keeping abortion safe and legal. And I'm also interested in who is going to sit on the Supreme Court that will make important decisions in the United States while my children are growing to adulthood, and that could well affect their lives. So there's a whole panoply of issues that I think are very, very important. The issue that has least surfaced in this campaign and that I find very compelling for myself and for the moral and ethical health of my kids is the poor. This has been a campaign built almost entirely around the well-being of the middle class. And while I'm well aware that the middle class has its problems, I spent the morning today at a soup kitchen in the Chelsea section of Manhattan, which I wrote an About New York column about 10 years ago when it opened. In those 10 years, I've had 3 children and gone through 3 jobs. And it never occurred to me in 1982 when I visited it that it would be anything but a temporary stopgap measure until government got on the ball about hunger in America. Not only has government not gotten on the ball, it seems like government isn't even interested in the game. And I would hope that whichever of these candidates wins, they would turn our attention back to people who are not having trouble making ends meet, but haven't had ends meeting for years and are going to bed every night with their stomachs empty.
If you were one of the journalists on one of the 2 debates with journalists asking the questions, do you know what questions you would have asked?
Yes, I would have asked about abortion. I would have asked about the genesis and the development of each of the candidates' positions on abortion, because while I think Mr. Perot either has been consistently the same or has not had to publicly declare his position until it was already fully formulated, both Governor Clinton and President Bush have changed somewhat on some of their attitudes. The president, of course, once was pro-choice, is now determinedly anti-choice, at least in his public posture. And Governor Clinton has been an advocate of some of the limitations upon legal abortion that those people who think abortion should be legal and untrammeled have not agreed with, most specifically parental notification. So I would have liked to have asked when they first began to think about the issue, how their opinions changed about the issue over the years, and what limitations they think should be put upon abortion if they think it should in fact be legal.
Before you wrote your current column, Public and Private, you wrote a column called Life in the 30s, which was a very personal column, and you'd write a lot about your family in it. You have 3 children now, so, I mean, obviously, you know, family issues are very important to you. How did you feel at around the time of the Republican Convention when, you know, the issue of traditional family values was being discussed so much?
Well, I was totally disgusted by it because of the families that they seem to be representing were not the families that I know. I mean, the idea that anyone in 1992 would still think that a family consists of a mother, a father, and 2 little kids all living in a house together and doing well is painfully naive. And I also thought that family values was a not very subtle cover for example, opposing equality for gay people in this country, opposing gay families, saying that if you became pregnant accidentally and decided to keep and raise a child on your own, that somehow you were less equal than a family that had a married mom and dad. So that while family values in the abstract sounds like a wonderful thing, and in fact, I'm constantly working on our family values, I thought it was code in this case for an exclusionary policy rather than an inclusionary one. Finally, I thought I saw a lot of family values today at this soup kitchen, but they were the values of giving and sharing and taking people in and offering them warmth on a very cold day. So that I don't like to limit my family values by blood. I really wished this morning, quite frankly, that my kids could have been with me and that they could have spent some time talking to the men and women I was talking to who are down on their luck but remarkably optimistic nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of traditional family values got very played up at about the time of the Republican convention. Then when that didn't seem to go over that big, the subject got played down.
Right.
What do you think that says? Do you think that it says that approach to family values won't play nationally in this country? Or do you think that that's going to surface again soon?
I think that it says that the American people are not stupid and that they understood what the subliminal message was to the family values approach and that they saw it not so subliminally when Pat Buchanan stood up and gave his absolutely hateful opening night speech in which he effectively disenfranchised about 2/3 of the American populace. You know, out there are many ordinary, traditional people who have found out over the years that their sons and daughters are gay. And out there are many ordinary, traditional people who have had to cope with their own or their children's splintered marriages and with babies who came along at a time when they weren't necessarily expected, and with relationships that perhaps didn't exist or were hidden 50 years ago. Those people in their own lives have learned to roll with those punches, and I don't think they liked it one bit. When one of the standard bearers of the Republican Party stood up and started to jettison their children and their grandchildren before their eyes.
What do you want to know about the candidates' families? How relevant is it to you whether the candidates have had affairs or not, and how many children they have, and how close they are to their children?
Well, I think you learn something about a man by learning that. I think if a man is not close to his kids and he has regrets about that, you know something about the way in which he's grown and developed as a person. If he is close to his children, I think that says some very good things about him. In terms of their marriages, I like to know that men treat their wives with respect and that they see them as full partners and sentient human beings. I was very disappointed at the debate, for example, that when Susan Rook of CNN quite properly raised the question of why the inner circles of all three of these men are inhabited almost exclusively by white guys, that Governor Clinton did not say, one of my two or three closest advisors is female and she happens to be my wife. I'm sure he felt that he couldn't say that because of the heat that Hillary's taken, but given her resume and given her intelligence and her achievements, I find it very disappointing that in America he didn't feel free to say that. And I found it very dispiriting that Ross Perot still thinks the answer to a question about full equality for women in our society is to cite his four beautiful daughters. I'm real pleased that he has a nice family, but that doesn't answer the question about why he doesn't have a woman in his inner circle to advise him on policy.
Do you think Hillary Clinton has begun to reemerge? She seemed to be kept hidden away for a while.
She better reemerge. I mean, here's a woman who, if Bill Bradley was elected president, would certainly be on any short list for, if not a cabinet-level position, at least a sub-cabinet-level position. If this country uses that woman to cut ribbons for the next 4 years, if her husband is elected president, it will be a real shame, and it'll show how little we've advanced in terms of the treatment of women.
John Kennedy appointed his brother Robert Kennedy to be attorney general. If Bill Clinton appointed Hillary in a top-level position, do you think that that would be accepted?
I think that the scream that you'd hear would be heard round the world.
Do you think it would be inappropriate?
Yes, I suppose I do think it would be inappropriate, much as I think that she is qualified for almost any high-level position in government. I think it was inappropriate when Bobby Kennedy was appointed. Mm-hmm. In fact, Clark Clifford tells this wonderful story about going to Joe Kennedy to try to tell him that this is a terrible idea, and the Kennedy patriarch sitting there nodding his head, and then at the end saying, Clark, I just want to tell you one thing. Bobby Kennedy is going to be the Attorney General of the United States. I think that it's better not to appoint family members to high positions in your administration. However, if they are talented and accomplished and well-informed, I think seeking their counsel constantly and letting them use those skills in an unpaid and unappointed position is most important.
I'm wondering if during the conventions when all the candidates had their families, you know, up at the podium, if your children were judging the candidates by what their kids look like, and if they look like the kind of kids that they'd be friends with.
No, but my kids have been very judgmental about the candidates. I actually watched the vice presidential debate with my eldest, who is 9 years old, because he had the assignment to watch it and write about it. And he was very critical of all three of them, even though he has strong opinions about who he thinks should be president. He said that Al Gore acted like America, like he was the teacher and America was the kids. He said all Dan Quayle could say is Bill Clinton can't tell the truth, and what about all the poor people in the country? And he said that Ross Perot picked the wrong person to be vice president. He wrote that in his essay. So he's been quite critical of the candidates, but he hasn't said anything about their kids. I'm not sure that he gets a sense of how public children become under those circumstances, because although I have a very public job, my kids have a very private life, which has been real important to me, not to have them exposed to too much of the heat or the flack or even the adulation that sometimes comes with being a New York Times columnist.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Anna Quinlan, columnist for the New York Times, and we're talking about the presidential campaign. She also has a novel called Object Lessons that recently came out in paperback. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times columnist Anna Quinlan, and I should mention that tomorrow we'll be joined by her colleague William Sapphire, who is also a columnist for the New York Times and writes from a much more conservative point of view.
The excellent conservative columnist, Bill Sapphire.
Yeah.
I actually greatly admire him. I mean, no one can work a telephone the way Bill Sapphire can.
Yeah, what have you learned by watching him work a telephone?
That reporting is a critical part of writing an opinion column, and that the very best opinion columns are written not by people who lean back in their chair and think deep thoughts, but by people who call everyone they can get their hands on and say, what do you think about that?
So do you do that ever?
Yeah, sure.
Who do you
call? That's why I went to that soup kitchen today.
Uh-huh.
Well, with me, it's more being out on the street, because There are people who would write a column about the economy by talking to Felix Rohatyn or Alan Greenspan, and I certainly pay close attention to the pronouncements of those wise men. But for me, more of the economy is contained in the astronomical numbers of people who are being fed for free at places like the place I visited today than in looking at the economic indicators.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why this campaign has seemed to become a national drama in a way that campaigns of the recent past have not?
Well, first of all, because we feel like we're in real trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The ship of state sailed on, and sometimes we were interested in its course, and sometimes we didn't think that its course had much to do with us. But right now it has a hole in the bottom, and the water is coming in, and all of us have been bailing for 4 years, whether because we were in danger of losing our homes or because our kids couldn't afford to go to college or couldn't afford to go to the college of their choice, or because we'd gotten pink slipped. And so I think that the reason that people are most keenly interested is because there's a sense that we need some sort of a change in direction, a new course. But it's also been a race in which every conceivable issue has been played out. I mean, we've gone over and over the question of how much character matters, of how much marital fidelity matters, of whether drug use matters, of whether military service matters.
Yeah, and in that respect, I think that this campaign has been more like a novel than your average campaign.
It has.
Because the characters keep getting more and more complicated and developed.
But I've got to tell you, too, I think it's been very useful because certain of those issues, I think, have been put to rest for all time.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the drug issue. I don't think that's ever going to be a real issue in a campaign again.
Yeah, well, what happens though if they bring up that somebody did LSD the next time or cocaine or something as opposed to like inhaling?
I'm still not sure that it's going to track real well, because of course the other thing that you've seen in this race is this generational split.
Yeah, well, I wonder how you feel. This is the campaign in which a presidential candidate is closer to your generation than any other presidential candidate has been. Has that affected your involvement with the campaign in any way?
Well, certainly I've understood so much of what he's been saying. I mean, when the president says that he just doesn't get the anti-war activities, I not only get them, but to some small extent, I was involved with them. And I've certainly understood a lot of the Sturm und Drang about Hillary Clinton, because she's had to make so many of the choices that I've had to make and that my friends have had to make. And the marijuana controversy, I mean, I remember very well writing a column when I was writing Life in the 30s that began. I remember the first time I smoked marijuana. It was the closest I ever thought I was going to come to losing my job. And, of course, that was because I was underestimating the men who run the paper. So that a lot of this has seemed terribly real to me, but in some sense terribly unimportant, because I'm part of a whole group of people who passed through those things and then went on to something else. And so the idea that there was somehow something indelible about them, I think, seemed unrealistic to us.
Usually election time is a time when a lot of people get angry at the media for one reason or another.
Right.
And we have President Bush saying now, don't listen to some crackpot who comes on after the debate and tells you what to think. What do you think of the way the candidates have been portraying the press?
I think the press has done a really good job in this election. I think that most newspapers and television networks know that they did not handle the 1988 campaign as well as it could have been handled. That they did not dig enough in terms of claims made by both sides. That the coverage was too driven by spin doctors and not enough by skeptical reporting, and that what you're seeing in 1992 is a reaction to that. I think we've covered the waterfront on this one in a way that I've been very, very pleased by. And I think that any discussion of the relationship between the press and the people that suggests that the people sit there and let us spoon-feed them our biases and conclusions is completely flawed and totally underestimates the American people. The president should know well, if he's talked to even a dozen Americans, that this is not a country where people sit there and watch Robin McNeil and say, I'm going to go right down the line with everything that he's just said, or Gergen and Shields, or Jeff Greenfield on ABC. The fact of the matter is, because of cable, because of the way we're covering this election, because of C-SPAN, we are now in a position to get more information than ever before. And I think the American voter is sucking up all that stuff, turning it over in his mind, and then saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do.
Anna Quinlan, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. You're welcome.
Anna Quinlan is a columnist for the New York Times and author of the novel Object Lessons. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, a more conservative perspective on the elections from Quinlan's colleague at the Times, William Sapphire. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a dance for militant dilettantes. That's the first poem in Al Young's new collection, Heaven. We'll talk with Young about his poems and about the writing of his alter ego, O.O. Gubuga. It's Young's satirical answer to the cliched expectations of the black poet. Also, a new mystery by Patricia Highsmith. Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. More details are emerging from the latest evidence from military archives in Vietnam. Thousands of photographs of American soldiers captured or killed by Vietnamese forces were apparently brought back this week by a U.S. delegation. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
Yesterday, the Pentagon contacted the family of a Kentucky airman who had been listed as missing in action. The family was told that one of the photographs found in the Hanoi archives showed that he had died when his plane was shot down over Vietnam in 1968. The collection of pictures and documents now in the hands of U.S. investigators is a major advancement in resolving the cases of more than 2,000 Americans listed as missing in action. But Mary Backley of the National League of Families says the pictures may be worth little if they don't deal with soldiers listed as missing in action.
I don't think it's a major breakthrough as of yet. It will become a major breakthrough if, in fact, it does end the uncertainty for families.
More details of what the U.S. delegation brought back will be announced at the White House tomorrow morning. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Rabin has confirmed that Israel has offered Syria a partial pullout from the Golan Heights in exchange for peace. This offer came in a new document that Israel presented yesterday as the Middle Eastern peace talks resumed in Washington. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
As the seventh round of U.S.-sponsored Middle East peace talks continued today, Prime Minister Rabin said Israel knows that it is impossible to get peace from Syria just for peace with Israel. But Rabin also said he is not willing to pay the price Israel paid with Sinai for peace with Egypt. In other words, Rabin rejected a complete withdrawal. Also today, Syrian television invited Druze poet Samih al-Qassem to visit Damascus. It is the first time that a government-linked Syrian institution has invited an Israeli citizen to visit. Al-Qassem is the editor of the Kul al-Arab weekly newspaper published in Nazareth and a longtime activist in the Communist Party. As a Druze, he is ethnically Arab and his religious principles are an offshoot of Islam. Prime Minister Rabin welcomed the invitation, saying he would be happy if Israelis were welcome in all Arab countries. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Veteran sports announcer Red Barber died this morning at the age of 84. In 1934, Barber began broadcasting games for the Cincinnati Reds. Then he moved on to the Dodgers 5 years later. After leaving the Dodgers over a salary dispute, he worked for the New York Yankees for 12 years. In January of 1981, Barber began a weekly segment on NPR's Morning Edition talking about everything from baseball to flowers. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 14 points to close at 3,288 on volume of more than 216 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Officials at the State Department have expanded their probe into file searches on Bill Clinton after the Washington Post reported that Clinton's mother's files had also been probed. Acting Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger ordered the investigation after reports that state had directed an expedited search of Clinton's passport records. At question is whether State Department officials have been attempting to aid President Bush's campaign under the cover of Freedom of Information Act request. Clinton has called these latest reports about his mother's investigation pathetic. A federal appeals court in Chicago has ruled that insurance companies cannot redline or deny insurance policies to homeowners because of where they live. This ruling could pave the way for numerous lawsuits. Marge Petroff of member station WUWM reports.
The lawsuit was initially filed in 1990 by 8 homeowners in Milwaukee. They accuse American Family Mutual Insurance Company of discriminating against them by denying them homeowners insurance because they're black and live in a deteriorating neighborhood. The homeowners have been joined in their lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP, who claim the practice of redlining violates the Federal Fair Housing Act. And the Federal Appeals Court in Chicago has agreed. American Family says it bases its policy decisions on risk, not on racial stereotypes, and looks forward to proving its case in court. If the appeals court decision is not reversed, the ACLU predicts many people will file lawsuits against insurance companies, particularly homeowners who live in segregated urban neighborhoods. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Pitroff in Milwaukee.
After a weather delay of nearly 2 hours, the Space Shuttle Columbia finally was cleared for liftoff early this afternoon. All but one of the 6 astronauts on board have been in space before and will take part in experiments including one to learn more about earthquakes. The shuttle is NASA's oldest. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Titles like Things Ain't What They Used to Be, Kinds of Blue, and Bodies and Soul are a pretty good clue to one of Al Young's passions, music. Each of those books is a collection of his memories which relate in some way to jazz, rhythm and blues, or rock. Young has been a singer and a guitarist. Now when he gets in front of an audience, it's to read or to teach. This semester he's a visiting professor at the University of Michigan, his alma mater. Teaching and readings have taken him around the world. He says his writer's voice is the product of contrasting influences, the North and the South, the city and the country. He grew up in Detroit and Mississippi. Al Young has a new collection of poems called Heaven, which brings together his work from the 50s through the 90s. This is the opening poem.
A dance for militant dilettantes. No one's going to read or take you seriously, a hip friend advises, until you start coming down on them like the black poet you truly are and ink in lots of black in your poems. Soul is not enough. You need real color shining out of real skin, nappy, snaggly, afro hair. Baby, grow up and dig on that. You got to learn to put in about stone black fists coming up against white jaws and red blood splashing down those fabled wine and urine-stained hallways. Black bombs blasting out real white estate, the sky itself black with what's to come. Final Holocaust, the settling up. Don't nobody want no nice nigger no more. These honkies, man, that put out these books and things, they want an angry splib, a furious nigra. They don't want no bourgeois woogie. They want them a militant nigger in a Fiji haircut, fresh out of some secret boot camp, with a bad book in one hand and a Molotov cocktail in the other. Subject to turn up at one of their conferences or soirees and shake the shit out of them.
Al Young, how come you opened your new collection of poems with this particular poem?
Probably because the book is done largely in chronological order, and my first book, Dancing, appeared in 1969 in the very midst of the Black Rage era, when it was very marketable to be angry and black.
And you felt that not fitting quite into that category made you less saleable as a poet?
No. This was actually a commentary on the times. In other words, I was victimized as an artist by this particular commercial push.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make a little fun of it, and at the same time, just show everybody that this is not a hard thing to do.
Now, you have a more recent poem in your book called Your Basic Black Poet, in which you talk about people thinking that if you're not talking about race, if you're black and you're not talking about race in your poems, then you're not relevant.
That's right. It's a very sad situation. I'm categorically against typing, typecasting, or stereotyping of any kind. And we do this to each other in grandiose ways now with a little electronic help. And My interest now is more in how much we have in common rather than how we differ.
In that poem, Your Basic Black Poet, it says, well, if he was from Johannesburg, better yet from Mozambique or even from St. Martin's, it would be
right.
easier to relate.
That's right.
Is that like the happening thing now if you're black to be African? Is that what you feel is the most marketable thing now, you know, in terms of literature?
Well, it helps if you're in North America. It helps not to be African-American in the same way that it's against your interest to be Senegalese or from Martinique in France. In other words, at the center of whatever happened to be the colonial power, they're always interested in the exotics, the ones who come from somewhere else. In other words, these aren't our people that we have kicked around. These are people that somebody else has kicked around. You know, it's I have a poem about that in the book, as you probably noticed. It's called More Clues to the Blues.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in France, and I'm okay, I'm cool, because I'm from the States, and I'm from a place that produced wonderful James Baldwin and Richard Wright and Josephine Baker and jazz and all of that, so I'm cool. But if I'm one of their former colonized peoples, then I catch hell.
You've actually created an alter ego to take care of the expectations of,
that's right.
of what a black poet ought to be.
That's right.
Can you tell us about your alter ego?
Yes. His name is O.O. Gbuga. O.O. Gbuga comes from Ugabuga. I don't know if that noun has made it into the Random House or the Webster's on a Bridge yet, but I remember when Hugh Masekela came to this country, he put out an album called The Americanization of Ugabuga. And Ugabuga, of course, goes back to Tarzan, Johnny Weissmuller, Republic Pictures, B-movie days, when we'd sit in theaters on 12th Street in Detroit and watch these so-called natives in loincloths and tiger skins with spears. They were actually from West Los Angeles, and a lot of them were musicians. It was called sidelining, and you actually got $75 a day for playing a native. But they would say things like, Ooga Booga, Mbawa Masa, this kind of thing. And Hugh Masekela once said that even though he grew up in Johannesburg in South Africa, he would see these Tarzan movies when he was a kid, and he thought that somewhere in Africa there were people who talked this way. So when he went to France, he and his expatriate African buddies would sit around the cafes, and they would carry on this Ooga Booga talk to blow the French away. So when he got here, he recorded the Americanization of Ooga Booga, and I heard it, and I said, that's it. O-O Gbuga.
Well, in your new book, Heaven, Collected Poems, you have a piece called Boogie with O.O. Gbuga.
That's right.
Can you read an excerpt of that for us?
Yes. This comes to me as an introduction to Brother Gbuga and his way of looking at the world. It's sort of a biography. It's the kind of thing you'd see on the back of an album jacket. Boogie with O.O. Gbuga. O.O. Gbuga writes that he was, quote, born in a taxicab, right smack on 125th and Lenox in Harlem on Lincoln's birthday, 1945. Franklin Delano Watson was the name my poor brainwashed parents gave me, but I had that racist tag legally altered once I got old enough to see what was going down. The O-O, by the way, stands for our own, i.e. we need to do our own thing. Can you dig it? In addition to being one of our strongest young black revolutionary voices, Brother Gbuga is the author of half a dozen volumes, all of which have appeared since last year. Slaughter the Pig and Get Yourself Some Chitlins is the title of his most popular work, which is presently in its sixth big printing. Other volumes include Niggers with Knives, Black on Back, Love is a White Man's Snot Rag, and Taking Names and Kicking Asses. His plays, Transistor Willie and Latrine Lil, and Go All the Way Down and Come Up Shaken, a revolutionary black musical, received last month's Drama Authority Award. A militant advocate of the oral tradition, O.O. Gbuga chooses to dictate his poems through me rather than write them down himself.
Oh, that's wonderful. My guest is Al Young, and he has a new collection of poems called Heaven. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Writer Al Young is my guest. He has a new collection of poems called Heaven. Okay, another poem I want you to read, and this is called By Heart. But before you read it, I want to say that a lot of your writing over the years has been influenced by music, particularly by jazz. And you have several books of kind of memories that have been sparked by listening to jazz records.
And, yes.
This is in part a music-related poem. In part, it gets to other, I think, interests of yours.
That's right. That's a nice way to put it, Terry. By heart, the leaves on the trees, the smell of the ocean, the feel of the earth. We sit embalmed in lonely clubs at night, remembering this, feeling sorry for ourselves, when all the time God is whispering and singing along the telephone wires of our secret hearts, telling us, I love you, showing us how. And yet, we shut that soft voice out like the wind in a leaky cabin. We know all this by heart, but we forget until the singer makes the insides of us tremble like the leaves on the trees. Then suddenly we smell the ocean and feel the earth whirling around and around the worlds of lazy space between our thoughts.
That's really nice.
Thank you.
One of the things I like about that poem is it gets to three things that are in a lot of your poems: music, nature, mysticism.
Yes.
Kind of puts it all together. But it's so hard to capture what music does for you when it really connects.
Well, I think I can partially articulate it. I think music is very close to spirit in that neither is seeable. They're invisible forces that nevertheless have profound effects on us. I still doubt that we have even nicked the iceberg in terms of understanding what music is and how it affects us. And the same thing with our spirituality, which I use in a very loose sense. I'm not talking about theism of any kind or religion of any kind. I'm talking about human spirit, which is basically what we're made of.
Well, Al Young, there's another poem I want you to read. And this one is called January.
Oh, yes.
And I think a lot of people will relate to this poem.
January. The VW needs serious transmission work. The Datsun blows a radiator hose. Blue Cross wants $425 right away. The last checks of December come back, bouncing off the wall at 8:50 a crack. The turntable quits spinning. Mildew overtakes the bathroom walls. There's $50 worth of developed pictures at Photomat you can't afford to pick up. The old typewriter is going to cost $30 to fix up so you can rent it out. You bite into an apple and hurt your molar on the stem, the same molar with root canal work done last January, and it's time to go in for a checkup. They're going to kick you out of the Screenwriters Guild if you don't pay the 2 years back dues. The city of Los Angeles owes all the money you spent in travel costs to do a gig way back in December, way back in November. The radio you bought your son for graduation fell apart, and it's cheaper to buy a new one than have his fixed. The Christmas briefcase your wife gave you, its handle slipped off already. Prospects keep growing colder as the water you're in grows hotter. You know it's January when you have to stop and pay close attention to what you're doing wrong that seemed oh so right last July.
That's great. When did you write it, and is there a story behind that one?
I actually wrote that during such a January, and everything that I was amazed when I read that. I've never read that poem aloud before. I'm amazed that all of these things actually came back, that I put all that down. That's literally what was on my mind in January of, I don't know, I think we're dealing here with the early 80s somewhere.
Let me ask you to read us a poem to close with.
Okay. A poem for Dylan Thomas. When night moved through the air of that almighty sleep, you stumbled. I dove fast to catch you falling there, undreamed, the drowsing king of consonants. And in that mirrored state, the whole of Wales ignored, you dragged me down at once into your deep, bright, ringing countryside. There are no names for lines as yet unsung, that hang, that dangle scantly from the heart's tight, high-wired rope. Hope is what your songs stirred up in me. They left me with no choice. I went right on voicing all I'd heard and seen and breathed down there inside your dream, and mixed it well with wishes and bewitchments of my own. We probed all nights together, separately, and daylight was never so gentle as it was the medicinal afternoon you woke and slipped away to smell the sweet, brisk air, to swallow the sea. All small craft warnings be damned.
When did you write that?
1990.
And what was the occasion?
I was remembering Dylan Thomas and how much of a debt I owed to him, because when I was first getting seriously interested in writing poetry in the 1950s, Thomas's presence was everywhere. And he was touring American campuses and cities. I like to think restoring poetry to its natural place as a spoken phenomenon. And his voice, as you'll recall, was just so wonderful. It was so mellifluous and rich, sonorous, that I was touched by it and took a deep interest in his poetry, which I started to memorize, and realized that there was something to this more than met the ear or eye.
Al Young, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us and for reading some of your poems.
It's been an absolute pleasure, as always, Terry. Thank you.
Al Young's new collection of poems, Heaven, is published by Creative Arts Books. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, I was very sorry to hear that Red Barber passed away today. How will you be remembering him?
We have an obituary which looks back, Terry, at some of his great moments in his career and some of the great moments on our air. It's really very nice and very lovingly prepared by the people at Morning Edition for whom Red worked for so long. We're also going to cover a lot of politics, polls, and Ross Perot. Voter registration is apparently up, and so is Ross Perot in the polls, something of a bounce from the debates, apparently, and we'll have a stump speech from the Libertarian candidate today.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In Europe, American writer Patricia Highsmith is so well known, she's regularly stopped on the streets for her autograph. But in this country, despite the fact that some of her books, like Strangers on a Train, have spawned popular movies, she's only attracted occult readership. Critic Maureen Corrigan says one explanation is that American readers of crime fiction are confused by Highsmith's amoral explorations of perverse behavior. Highsmith's new book, Ripley Underwater, is her first novel in 12 years to feature the charming sociopath Tom Ripley. Maureen has a review and a warning.
Entering the world of a Patricia Highsmith novel is like having one of those dreams where you're sitting in your own living room and everything seems normal, until you suddenly realize that you're having a dream. Then odd things begin to happen, like maybe the television sprouts tentacles or Adolf Hitler sits down on the couch next to you. You struggle to wake up, but it's no good. The harder you try, the more you experience the terror of your own paralysis. And even after you finally do awake and say to yourself, it was only a dream, you still regard the living room furniture with a lingering sense of unease. Reading Highsmith gives you that same disturbing after effect. Her novels skew your ideas of literary justice, tilt your internal scales of right and wrong. Sure, you can tell yourself that it was only a book, but somehow the ethical order of things in the real world seems less stable. Ripley Underwater is the fifth in Highsmith's celebrated series about debonair conman and murderer Tom Ripley. The novel opens with Ripley enjoying his leisure at his charming villa in the French countryside. Pity about those bloodstains on the villa's cellar floor, but then blood is so hard to remove. Unfortunately, a boorish American couple named Pritchard has just moved into the neighborhood. It's bad enough they play loud rock music and wear garish clothes, but David Pritchard also seems to be slyly knowledgeable about the string of mysterious deaths and disappearances that have befallen Ripley's acquaintances. Pritchard is especially curious about the fate of an art collector named Murchison, last seen in Ripley's company in the second novel of the series, Ripley Underground. A tense game of cat and mouse ensues. Pritchard makes prank phone calls to Ripley, pretending to be another dead friend. He trails Ripley and his wife on their vacation to Morocco, and he drags local canals searching for Murchison's waterlogged bones. When Ripley questions Janice Pritchard about her husband's motives, she demurely explains, David just likes to see people wilt, if he can make them wilt. But this time, Pritchard has selected a deadly prey. The bizarre but undeniable pleasure of reading Ripley Underwater arises from both the suspense of the psychological contest with Pritchard and from the dawning, horrific awareness that as readers, we're drawn to Ripley. We root for him to keep his gory secrets hidden and go on living the guilt-free good life. And in a climax that's reminiscent of the end of Dorothy Sayers' greatest mystery, The Nine Tailors, even nature seems to side with Ripley. In Ripley Underwater, Patricia Highsmith once again proves herself to be a master of the macabre. But what's really chilling is the way she so deftly warps the moral sense of her readers. Even after you close this strange book, you're left with the strangeness of your own responses.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nattering Nabobs of Negativism, a talk with the man who wrote that phrase for Vice President Spiro Agnew. William Safire is a former speechwriter for the Nixon administration and a longtime columnist for the New York Times. After voting Republican all his life, he says he's thinking the unthinkable. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.